I came across the study in part of the work that council's doing around the wharf, yes. And it seems to be principally about examining what the underwater conditions are like around the work area. Is that primarily what that's about?
Yes, the work area, and then you would have seen we also looked at two areas that have similar kind of physical makeups in the harbour, but won't be impacted by any kind of works. So,
okay, so that's as a comparison.
Yeah, so those are the control sites, and the sites at the wharf will be the impact sites where the actual work will go on.
Okay, and I guess we go to what have you found? Are things okay down there at the moment?
Mostly okay. There's some really interesting stuff there, but there's nothing out of the ordinary that you wouldn't find in the Raglan Harbour or in this part of New Zealand. The what's being planned, unfortunately, very small construction footprints and where they are being the harder works are being done. There's basically not much living at all. So if we think about on the eastern side, there's going to be a bit of a boardwalk around where those cliffs are. There's basically no life there. The Pūtakauas above are important, and there's a whole plan on them. But
okay,
where that is, there's a bit of scoured gravel and some green slimy algae, a bit of anthropomorpha, and that's about it. So
is that because that's where the boats are going in?
No,
it's impacted.
No, it's because of the substrate. So it's a sandstone there, so it's not very good for things to stick onto, like encrusting organisms. And then when the tide comes in, there's that gravelly sand there that just washes around. So again, it's a really hard, abrasive environment to live in. So that's why there's nothing at the top of the tide there.
And that's where the pontoon's going to go, around that area.
Yeah, so then the pontoon comes off of that. So that'll be, from what I understand, it's a monopile structure will go out over where, at the moment, there's the kind of shore parallel, like where they bring in the boats to set them on.
Yeah.
So it'll come down beside that, and then the pontoon will be floating off the end of that.
Okay, a bit more life on the western side where... I know, they've actually taken it off the table now because they can't afford it right now, but there was going to be like just a nice place of people with steps down into the water.
Yes, yeah. So similar...
I mean, when we say life, like what sort of... I mean, there's...
Yeah, just, there's the... As you get nearer the low watermark, there's more and more life because, it's marine organisms and they want to be underwater most of the time. That intertidal area is a really harsh environment. You can imagine in the summer it's blazing sun on it and like yesterday at low tide you've got fresh water raining down and these are marine species, so it's a really harsh environment and the longer you're out of the water, the harder it is. So as you go down, there's more and more life, but just your normal... On the rocks, you've got encrusting organisms, your oysters and your barnacles and limpets, occasional different sea slugs and things, and then underneath your half crabs, those crabs with the one big claw, the little blue petrolithes, and mud crabs and a few rock crabs running around. So all sorts of the common kind of critters, but there's plenty of them down there.
So is the purpose of this report to show to the regional council as part of their giving consent to the project?
It is. It's part of the EIA. Getting mixed up. Here in New Zealand, it's an AE, an Assessment of Environmental Effects, an Environmental Impact Assessment. So it's looking what's there and then looking at what the construction processes involve, how much area, what the disturbances are, and make an assessment on how that will impact on that local ecology.
And... I mean, obviously, it's not your job to make the decision. That's the council's job. But, yes. I mean, this doesn't sound like a thing where they're going to say, oh, no, stop, we've got... Like, there's no unique species in the area or anything like that?
And also, it's when you're looking at marine ecology, you want to look at what kind of impact it is. So this kind of impact, there's two impact types of impacts we normally talk about, is a pulse impact. So something that happens once and then it's gone, and that's we get them all the time, like extreme rainfall events, or a press impact, and that could be something like a new sewage outfall where you've 24/7 there'll be fresh water with nutrients and that in it. Where so here it's a construction disturbance. you have an impact while you're doing it, and you look at ways to minimise that impact while you're doing that. Then once you've done, it's finished, and you'll get recolonisation. So a lot of the, you know, this often talk about the sea is a kind of soup of organisms looking for somewhere to live. So many of them are habitat restricted. They can't find that hard rock that hasn't already been covered in barnacles. So you open up some new space, and they quickly get colonised, and you'll get hydroids coming first. And then
that's almost an argument to do something.
Well, in some cases, you know, if we look at the monopiles going across the other side, you actually will increase the available habitat there. So, you know, you can say there's a slight positive offset once the work's done and it's finished and it's allowed to recover. Recover and recolonize. Okay.
What about around the existing wharf that's been there for a long time in the sediment? I understand there can potentially be toxins. Like, what's the story around there?
Yeah, so that has been a concern. So there's some sites that have got slightly elevated contaminants.
Yep.
And so those areas and it would have to just that material it would get removed to a dedicated landfill, so it's not released into the marine environment.
How on earth do you do that underwater?
Oh no, it's all mostly intertidal where we're.
Oh right. Here. Oh okay.
Yeah, so, no, it's not. It was on the look, and if you think about it, that wharf's been there probably more than 100 years, and there's been all sorts of works going on, so you can get those kind of accumulations.
Yeah.
So, but what was also done, which was a useful thing, was going around the rest of the harbour and other areas doing those same tests to say, you know, if you detect anything like that, you go, well, is this just background? Is our whole harbour contaminated, or is it just points? So from looking at other areas, we find that there's no problems at all. So it's just one or two point sources at the site.
Okay. All right. So that's not a big deal, something to be worried about.
No, I mean, and it's good the way it's dealt with these days. You know, you're actually removing it. So these are historical things that that have to be dealt with. You know, we're not like some of the harbours, like Auckland Harbour with the old TBT, the tribunal tin kind of antifoulants, which are really bad. And we stopped using them 20 years ago, but they're still in the sediments under the wharves there. So
I know. And in some ways, it feels quite kind of silly asking these questions when places like Auckland have got the impact would be a thousandfold probably of what we've got. But I know we like our area to stay how it is. And
improve it.
That's the story we've been getting over the last 25 years with the riparian management and the work of Harbour Care. I mean, has there been enough studies over that time and before that time to really say definitively how much it's improved?
Came up to a catch per unit effort study, and this was probably going back 10 years ago now. And originally, they looked at one 25 years before, so it was 35 years ago. And at that time, Raglan had the worst catch per unit effort for recreational fishing for a harbour in New Zealand.
That's quite impressive to be that bad, isn't
it? Yeah, it is. And so then that was, like I said, 10, maybe longer ago that I picked up that study, that the improvement, you know, we were right up there in the top in able to, the catch per unit effort, you know. So back 35 years ago, you weren't catching good-sized snapper in the harbour. And it was probably also partly to do with how bad the fisheries had been hammered out there. But myself, I guess, over the last about 20 years, looking, you know, first noticing seagrass come back. So I've been down on Cliff Street there for 18 years or so, and a couple of years in, seeing the small patches. So I used to use a handheld GPS to monitor these patches out there, and then I'd go for a run out across the footbridge and out to the harbour entrance and do the same there. Within about 5 years, there was just too many to monitor. And there, you know, with the Rangitahi Bridge work there, we were monitoring seagrass for that. They're very ephemeral and move around all the time, but the amount of seagrass in the harbour is huge in comparison to what it was just 20 years ago.
And it almost, I mean, the recovery's been so quick, and it feels like you just... I mean, I know that's a lot of planting, but then it's a big harbour too. So, you know, that's the way it's going to be. But once it's enough is done, Mother Nature just brings it all back really quickly, it would seem.
Yes. You know, and you know, there's some areas that it's very hard to, you know, that once they're filled with silt, which is our main problem, you don't have the mechanisms to flush them out. So our blind arms of our harbour, they probably will never recover to what they used to be. But, you know, the main parts, and again, seeing that all those flats out here off where the wharf is and that, you know, there was always a layer of mud. And now a lot of the time, you know, you might get a few rainfall events or a very wet winter and you'll get it back a bit, but then it's come. Then it washes back again, and you've got mostly sand there now, which is really
so.
Good.
What was the harbour like before we started clearing the bush from around the catchment? Like, do we actually know?
Can you say? From core samples, yeah. So you know, and all around the Waikato, all around New Zealand, the core samples show the same thing. So I may have my numbers slightly wrong, but I think, you know, pre-clearance of bush in different catchments, sedimentation rates in estuaries, you know, they are going to they capture sediment. There's no doubt about it. But they were, you know, with a, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 mils per year. Since we've cleared and turned to pastures and residential, we've seen rates that are, you know, up to 15, 25, 30 millimetres a year. So, you know, an inch of sediment a year. So, yeah, it is substantial. Associated with that has been the huge increase in mangroves. So mangroves will sit there dormant doing nothing. They are very responsive to both nutrients and sediment load. You start pouring sediment in and they explode. And a lot of work looking through the work in Auckland, we do a fair bit of coastal hazard work there, and you really see and match it to the aerial photographs. In 1968, there was half the mangroves there by 1978.
Okay.
Within 10 years, they've doubled. And yeah, so I think the Firth of Thames is a great example. 1950s, the Firth of Thames was white sandy bottom, mussel reefs, and very few mangroves. Now there's, you know, huge mangrove belts all around it, and 2 to 3 meters deep of terrestrial mud.
So that mangroves aren't very nice places for people, but there's quite a bit of life in them, is there?
There is. You know, our mangrove in New Zealand is it has been compared to, say, the pine forest, because there's only one species.
Oh,
you've got
okay.
Avicenna marina. So
it's a monocultural environment.
It is. So, you know, compared to a mangle overseas, which might have 8 to 12 species of mangrove in it, even so, you know, the primary production, so they're dropping their leaves off and adding to the primary production, so putting nutrients into the environment, but also the habitat that they make for a lot of foraging and nursery species. So there is a lot of life. And just in recent years, and a study last year came out through Fiji, that mangroves will sequester more CO2, up to 10 times more CO2 than a tropical rainforest.
Right.
So these clearances that we've been doing in the north and in Tauranga and that, they're questionable now. You know, if you're going to start removing mangroves, you're just going to start releasing, you know, sequestered CO2. And then most of it's in their root mass as well.
This is... It's never simple when you start dealing with the ecosystem, is it?
Like, not at all.
So we don't want the mangroves because that showed that there was too much silt coming into the harbour, but there's actually benefits from... And I guess that speaks to the resilience of the natural world as well.
It does. The huge amount of homeostasis in our natural world, and which tends to mask some of the bad things that are happening to it. You know, it can respond and last for a long time. And again, the newer approach now is starting to look. We get to these tipping points, and a new baseline is established because we've changed things. But that happens quite suddenly, and we don't know when it will happen.
Right. Yeah. And then, and once it's happened, it's too late.
It's very hard to get back again.
Yeah. Yeah. Hey, in a different subject area, the last time I talked to you and Jose, maybe a year ago, about the sand on the beaches and the lack of sand on the beaches, before we talk about the beach out by the surf club, I wanted to talk about at Papahua, across the footbridge to the left, there's an area down there before you get to the where the monument is, where... When I was down there, I felt like there'd been massive, like the land had been eaten away quite a lot, but I actually looked on Google Earth and it wasn't quite as bad as it felt like. But there is an area there where the sands, the sea is washed over and it's killing the grass, and it feels like the sea could be into the car park area quite soon if nothing is done. And my understanding is that since the old bridge was removed, that was acting like a groin, with the footpath went further out into the water than...
Yeah.
Is that just going to keep changing, and is there nothing we can do?
So it is a very benign environment. So, you know, it could almost be like a meander in that part of it that's going across. But it really did manifest about the time, a few years after the old footbridge was removed. And it was it used to be on that, the western side, there was a concrete causeway out to the edge of the bridge.
Yes. Which
was, so that formed basically a groin that was about 22 metres long, and that was stabilising that whole area, and we saw that build up, and really, I mean, engineering-wise, a way to stabilise a spit like that is often to have a terminal groin on it, and that footbridge was having a quite a big effect. Since that's gone, it is a very benign area. It's very protected from everything, but we are the beach is walking back at where the footbridge is as well, and the steepness, it used to be very steep, so that's getting more and more gentle as you widen, so the cross-sectional area is getting still the same.
Okay, yeah.
But it wouldn't be too hard to put in a low barrier between where the existing footbridge meets the land, so to speak,
yeah,
and the first pole to recreate what.
So you could do that. Is that allowable under the Resource Management Act, or how hard is that to do under the?
It shouldn't be too hard at all, and we discussed it with the council a few times, but and they were putting in monitoring all the way along, all the way down to the boat ramp and where the other erosion is occurring. So, but I'm not sure where that is, where that's at. But it's not a hard thing to do. And
it feels like nothing is happening. I emailed the comms department of the council last year and said, because I'd heard that there was going to be some planting there to try to help retain it. And they said, yeah, that's going to be done by August. That was last year. So now we're a year on, and nothing's happened. And there's a sense of fatalism about, like, you're the first person I've talked to who said, yeah, sure, we can put a groin in. You actually know what you're talking about, which is nice.
I think it's always been an important amenity, not only for people in Raglan, but from coming to Raglan in the weekend, especially
get
an El Nino summer and it's blasting southwesterly every day. It's a sheltered beach and it's packed out there. So.
Yeah, I know. And when our kids were little, that's where we took them.
Yes,
exactly. That was the safe place to go. As long as there weren't too many boats moving up and down, it was... it was a really safe place to bring them in the water. Yes. It's not like you abandon them to the water, but, there's just less to worry about. Okay, so that could actually be fixed if someone had the will to do it, basically, or is council wanting to get more data to prove that they need to do it?
The last, and we're going back a few years now, but that was the last that I was involved was setting up, and I sent them through, put the profiles here and we'll see how it's changing. Every few weeks, I take the bike out to the. I don't run it anymore. I take the bike out to the harbour entrance, and I regularly take photos, and I've watched it change over especially over the last 5 years, and the whole morphology of that whole spit that is the campground where everyone has changed quite significantly.
Yeah, I was trying to look up my old photos to see if I had something from around there, because there's a lot of there's always activity there, and I was over the last 20 years I've been there taking a lot of photos, but I couldn't. In the end, I went for Google Earth, and I'd gone down there, and I felt like, man, this is massive. A massive amount has come out, but according to Google Earth, it's only 2 or 3 meters. It seems like, I don't know how accurate that is.
They do move around the coast on your Google Earth, so it's nice. You use the drawing tool to put a line on, say, the toilet block or something, and you can always measure off that.
Yeah.
It is a little hard, but it has moved a fair bit. Yeah, but you're right. It's probably, I think we're 5 to 6 meters about where the footbridge is, where the crest of the slope is, has moved now.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's slow, but it is changing.
Another thing I noticed there is there's decades ago they built a couple of little concrete walls, which maybe they built them to retain the land. But the one on the north side of the bridge, there's actually grass below the wall and comes out about, I don't know, 5 to 10 meters or something. So that's, there must have been a time when they were worried they were losing that area.
Yes,
in the past.
Yeah, and like, so it's hard to go back and see what was there before and how it's changed. But that footbridge had been there, that access to the footbridge had been there for a long, long time, and so that was a stabilising feature.
Yeah, yeah. But ideally, I guess, I don't know, I'm just as someone who lives here, I want to see it stay how it was.
Yes, you know, I don't want to lose the beach amenity.
And yeah,
yeah, and I said whether it also that it's connected to the erosion further down there by the boat ramp and the monument, potentially. Yeah,
yeah, I know Ngāti Mahanga are very worried about the, don't want the monument to be undermined. Obviously,
yes,
that's fairly significant. So back round to go out to the beach by the surf club. And we talked to you a couple of years ago, well, no, a year ago, I think. And, well, we know what happened. We lost the lookout tower. Yes. Are we continuing to lose sand out there?
Yeah, well, that scarp has really moved right along the, you know.
When you say scarp, what's a scarp?
I guess the main area of erosion.
Yeah.
You know, the sand in general tracks from the south to the north on our west coast. We're a little bit out of alignment with the southwesterly swells, so they hit the coast and push the sand to the north. You know, that reverses all the time, you know, when we get nor'westerlies. But in general, there's a net transport of, say, 180,000 cubic metres of sand to the north. And what we're seeing now, and I was actually just down there on Sunday, that the really aggressive erosion has moved from down in that corner and is now, you know, Elephant Rock is about 5 metres high. It doesn't even look like Elephant Rock anymore. But the area to the south of that is now starting to recover and fill with sand. So, I mean, we've seen these episodes all the way back through the historical aerial photographs. At the same time as we're getting it, we're seeing the same thing in Port Waikato. So, yeah, I was there.
Oh, yeah, they're having a bad time up there, aren't they?
Yes, so we're actually working on now, by the end of the month, should have a temporary resource consent in to be able to push up about 1,000 cubes of sand within each calendar month.
Is that enough? Is that going to be enough up there?
We're hoping it'll be enough to buy time until it comes back. And honestly, it is. I was there last Monday just doing ecology surveys there for the area. So really wanting to push sand up from the below the half, the mean tide to the low tide mark.
Yeah.
Like we've seen in Raglan, there's no life in that sand at all. It's far too mobile on a basis. You see how much it changes in one tide and one event. So, but yeah, it is really bad there at the moment.
The interesting thing I learned from you guys last time was that we kind of have this narrative, this modern narrative, that everything's in decline because people are ruining the planet. But that you said that the sand comes up the coast and kind of waves and this is like a multi-year process. So sometimes it's scouring out, and then a new source of sand will appear around the mountain, washed up, and rebuild the beach again.
Yes.
Yep. So that's, is there like a cycle? Can you say this happens every 20 years, every 30 years, or is it a bit more random?
It is a bit more random. There's some work that Roger Shand did looking at sand coming around the headland Indies area that suggested every 20 years. We saw, the last time we saw a big pulse come into the Raglan embayment was in 2004, and through 2004, 2005, some of the older surfers would remember that at low tide the waves didn't hit outsides and they broke really wide at indicators. And when that pulse first came through, we estimated possibly up to 1 million cubic meters of sand had come around the headland, and we had a lot of sand in our embayment. And but there's been no significant new pulses since then, and that's where we're, as well as we've had a lot of events that have pulled the sand offshore. So there's still a lot of sand in the Raglan embayment, but it's out in the middle of that bay. A couple of years back, there was a huge bank out there, almost a kilometre offshore, that everyone was surfing. Yeah.
So it's constantly changing.
Constantly changing. And it's the, you know, It's the combination of things that come together that change it, so that every time it's different, you know. And sometimes we might have, you know, screaming nor'westerlies that are holding the water up really high, but a really big southwesterly groundswell. If that all happens on one of the biggest tides of the year, huge amounts of sand get dragged offshore, which is what we saw.
So should we have built that surf tower there? Well, probably obviously not. Like, anyone can answer that. But do we get overconfident? Because for the last 10 or 20 years, it had been okay.
Well, we do. Short memories. And I think, as we talked last time, we saw that in 1974, the beach in that area was actually to the base of the cliffs. And that's what we look back at that, and that's what prompted Vodafone to move their fibre optic cable terminal right up to the base of the cliff 3 years ago or so.
Yeah, they're obviously there for the long term.
Yeah, so, right. You know, and we've seen the cable come up a few times. It was up again last year with such low sand levels.
Mm. There was just one thing I wanted to touch on, but we're kind of running out of time, that we've seen. Maybe it's because everyone has a cell phone and it's easier for people to record things these days, but flooding down at Lorenzen Bay, the houses on the waterfront there, I guess that's just going to keep happening, isn't it?
It is, and you know.
And is that because of climate change and sea level rise? I mean, the sea level hasn't risen that much.
Sea level, no, probably sea level's risen about a foot in the last 100 years or so, 120 years ago from records.
That's a lot.
It is when you start, you know, it doesn't sound much vertically, but on very low, gently lying land, it is a lot. And, talk about climate change and the sea level rise. We actually have the data. We see that it's rising. We see that it's rising faster. So, and another aspect of climate change that is projected is that there are increasing westerly wind and wave events.
So, and that's what causes the problem on this side of the harbour.
It pushes more and more water into the harbour, especially when it comes out of the nor'westerly direction, which the water, you get tide on tide and not as much water can come out as goes in.
Yeah.
Low pressures, the wind fetch over a long, long way where the nor'westerly sets it up. It's called wind setup, so there's a whole lot of factors, and if they come together, we get these very, very high water levels and flooding events.
And I guess it goes into the political realm as to what you do about the properties down there, which, I mean, one of those houses must have been built in the 50s, I think, so, or maybe the 60s, so it's been there for 60 or 70 years.
Yes, so
it would have been different when it was built.
It would have been, you know, and again, we're working on coastal hazard assessments, and the numbers that we have to use for how much sea level is rising, projection just keeps on going and going and going. We were 10 years ago at 0.59 metres, now we're using 1.4 metres.
It happens so slowly. Like, yeah, when you say those numbers, we have to add that much to it, that seems substantial, but we might not see that in our lifetimes.
No, these are 100-year projections. It's about not inheriting these problems and...
Yeah, I heard a great phrase the other night. I was listening to something and it said, we need to be good ancestors.
Exactly.
Yeah, which is not, I just thought that was such a good phrase because that really sums it up.
Yep, our future generations are living with us here now, not something that we imagine in the future.
Yeah, hey, Shaw, thanks heaps for coming in this morning and giving us the lowdown on how the harbour's doing. It's brilliant. Folks have been talking to Shaw Mead from eCoast, and where are you going to next?
Off to the British Virgin Islands on Thursday. Erosion problems at the Branson Estate.
We feel for the Bransons. Thanks, man.
Thank you. Bye-bye.